You know, I kept on thinking, how could I explain to you the difference between 1956 to 1996? Yeah, we're beginning a course on the Rav, and I have to tell you that the material you're going to hear in this course this year and in the ensuing years, this material was prepared over a period of 20 years, even more than 20 years. And I recognize that when you look at the course in totality, and you take what until now has been a three-year course, I have a suspicion this year it'll be a four. This time it'll be a four-year course. The material is uneven, meaning that when I started preparing the material, I was dealing with students who not only knew the Rav, they learned with the Rav, and I was getting them here in the Kollel basically after they studied with the Rav. And what I was doing, as far as material goes, was simply giving them material that they were not familiar with. As the years moved on, and particularly as you move into the late 80s, into the 1990s, students are listening to me who didn't know the Rav at all. And I found that the material I prepared at a later date, I absolutely reconstructed the shurim as the Rav gave them, literally word by word, not just the gist of the ideas, but word by word, even with the Rav's motions and jokes and sense of humor, so that you should have a total picture of who the Rav was. And of course, as time marches on, we're moving into 1996, we're dealing with students whose entire knowledge of the Rav is dependent upon what their teachers and what their Rebbeim are telling them. And all of you know that there are many images of the Rav that are being portrayed. Ultimately, the real Rav will win out, because there are so many tapes floating around that it becomes impossible to deny the word of the Rav. And just now, there was a machloket, one of his talmidim, and we'll come to this at a later date, but I just said this by way of introduction. One of his talmidim out on the coast, who has moved, if I may use the American terminology, more black. So Rabbi Wurzberger, who represents one of the Rav's earliest talmidim, out of the early 40s, so Rabbi Wurzberger quoted the Rav that he never sang the Hetter Meir Rabbanim. The Talmud on the coast said, this is impossible. How dare you quote the Rav like this? If there's such a thing as a Hetter Meir Rabbanim, then certainly the Rav signed. And he criticized by Wurzberger. I have the tape in my possession where the Rav says he never signed the Hetter Meir Rabbanim, and he explains why. And he has wrapped the shim in my book. If I'm not mistaken, it appears in the book, right? So, in the wrong book is my words for them. And
YULA Rosh Yeshiva. What's the microphone, perhaps, is a problem. Never a dull moment. But we have other microphones, but now I see we're on. You can make it a little lower now, I think a drop lower. So, if it's a machlokes between Rabbi Wurzberger and YULA, take my word for it that Rabbi Wurzberg is correct, you have a tape. But that's one example of 1956 versus 1996. I'll give you another example. That's a strong example because it's literally on the tape, and this guy on the coast went out in the line and went out in the limb and made a whole case and maledicted Rabbi Wurzberger, and he dare he, and it's impossible, and if the Rav said this, this is what it ha- how could the Rav have said this, and we have a Hetter Meir Rabbanim, and he washed the floor with Rabbi Wurzberger. And I can tell you, without taking any sides, who's the more honest and intellectually honest and more correct, all that matters now is that there's a tape, and the Rav in his own voice says, I never signed the Hetter Meir Rabbanim. There are reasons why. It's not for now. So I have a feeling the real Rav will win out. But if I can give you a stronger example of 1956 versus 1996, Bididi HaVeYuvda. My new book, which I've been working on since 1988, and the results from Shirim I gave in the Kol, I may even do it this year, I gave a number of Shirim dealing with the Rav as what I called a magic storyteller. I just heard a hesped, has paid him for the Rav that were given in England. Rabbi Milton Nordlich gave me a copy while I was in the States a few weeks ago. So he gave me a copy of the Hespedim in England. And I listened to the Hespedim, and there were basically four Rabbanim who spoke. Rabbi Skimchi, the chief Rabbi Sachs, Schulman, and Bernstein. Bernstein's no longer alive. He died shortly after this Hesped was given.
And Rabbi Bernstein, who was rabbi of the Jewish Center for a number of years, I believe the late 70s, early 80s, so Rabbi Isaac Bernstein describes the Rav as a tremendous storyteller. That the Rav had this unbelievable ability, a raconteur. And he describes the Rav at a Brit Milah with his cousin, with Rav Shaul Lieberman, and how people gathered around them. And for what appeared to be hours, the Rav went on telling stories. And that was essentially what I did in class. I showed the Rav as a magic storyteller, and the boys pleaded with me to write it up and turn it into an article. And once I started working on it, I saw that there's a lot more than just an article, that if it's done properly, it can be a major contribution. So Baruch Hashem, assisted by a student, I've been working since 1988, and it's a major work today. It's not just stories, it's insights, it's more than that, it has a biography. It's a major work, and Be'ezrat Hashem, I hope within the year it'll be completed. Now, but you'll see why I'm giving you this background. And this story says it all. In collecting stories the Rav told, and mind you, these are not stories about the Rav, these are stories the Rav told, so essentially, I depended upon my own memory, stories that I heard, and I depended upon, most of all, tapes, and we're talking in terms of, I wouldn't say much, a thousand hours of tapes were listened to, and every last story was pulled out of the tapes, be it in Yiddish, be it in English. We're dependent upon whatever the Rav has published. There are endless stories in the Ish Halacha, as you're familiar with. And in addition, I made it my business, if any reliable student of the Rav came up with a story, we checked it out, and there's a scholarly way, more or less, you can tell what's accurate, what's not accurate. Now, among the stories I came up with is that the student assisting me, whose name you should recognize, Rabbi Joey Epstein, Joseph Epstein, he put out the conspectus. And you know, I'm talking about the conspectus of the Rav Sheyuri HaRab. It was the first attempt made to pull the Rav Shurim together in the early 70s. It was 74. The Rav got hysterical at him. Then he made peace with him. It was just reissued by Ketav. If you're familiar with what happened after the Rav died, I think this is one of the first volumes to appear right after the Rav died. I don't recall whether Rav Heschel's volume came out first in Nefesh HaRab or whether this came out first, but they came out basically at the same time. So Joey tells me the Rav told a certain story when he was in Shia in the early 70s, a beautiful story about Volozhin with the Mishkanot Yaakov, Rav Chaim Volozhin, a beautiful story, and a story that really shows what Lithuania is all about. So Joey says to me, but you know, David Derovin was in the Shia then, and Rabbi Derovin, David Derovin, that's Linda Derovin's husband, who works in the YU office, he will remember the details better than I do. So I tell Joey, fine, contact David Derovin and get all the details from him. He contacts David Derovin, gets all the details, and then it feeds to me because I have to put it together, I have to write, I don't depend upon anyone else, and I have to work out the sources. And David Derovin, there's a footnote there that the Rav's top Talmud from the 70s, and I don't want to mention the name at this point, but well, suffice it to say, if you know who it is, it's fine. The Rav, in my opinion, out of the 40s, it could be his top Talmud was Reb Dov Tzvi Kanatopsky. Please close the door. Could be his top Talmud was Reb Dov Tzvi Kanatopsky. Those of you who are familiar with the name, Zeichel Tzadik Levracha, he taught in BTA when there was a high school in Brooklyn. Afterwards, he came uptown. Then he came in Aliyah. He taught with me in Mechala, taught at Bar Ilan, and he died a young man. Died, I believe, 74. Died, in his, he was, I think he was younger than I am when he died. Lo aleinu. Top Talmud out of the 50s is, of course, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. Top Talmud out of the 60s, in my opinion, is Reb Heschel Schechter. At the top, I mean, as far as basic Lumdus knowledge, I don't want to quibble. People can argue with me and say, this one has more, this one has less. I talk about the, if you want to know, I always say, Rabbi Aaron is the greatest Lumdin the Rav raised. The greatest builder of Torah is Steve Riskin. And I'll take the crown that I taught more Talmudim than any other Talmudim of, than any other Talmud of the Rav. Fine. But the greatest Lumdin, I think, is Reb Heschel Schechter. Out of the 70s, he had a towering student who should remain nameless, who was also my student. By the 60s, I was a Rebbe in the yeshiva, and he was my student, and he works his way up to the Rav, and he's a genius of geniuses. He sits in a kollel today in Meir Sharim, has a group around him. So David Derovin includes a note, let Rabbi Rakefet contact this person. So I contact him, and I work out, and he takes his notes from me. He's very well organized. He takes his notes from the shir, and he gives me, reads me word by word the story as he heard it, as he recorded it, at that time when the story was told. So now I have Joey Epstein's version, David DeRoven's version, and this great London's version, and I have to put it together as a readable story and put all the sources in, which I do. Then my minhag is as follows. When someone gave me a story, that story always has to go back to them. In other words, I want their approval before I go further. I don't want the volume to come out and Chaim Yankel is going to shout and scream, I never told him that, he made a mistake, it's not the facts. Okay. So I give the story back to Joey and I enclose a handwritten note on my stationery to this person and I write, dear, whatever his name is, and I, dear Chaim, and I write, please read as I've written out the story and let me know if there are any mistakes. Fine. I never hear from him. I never heard from him. He's a Talmud of mine. He's Maket Toiver. So he didn't have the guts to call me. Joey tells me that he meets him and they live in the same neighborhood. And he says to Joey, what Rabbi Rakefet did, it's terrible, it's horrible, it's not because it, you have no idea what you're doing to the Rav. And Joey says, what are you talking about? He says, he sent me back a copy of the way that story is going to look. And he begins, he writes in the story how the Mishkanot Yaakov used to visit his Rebbe, Reb Chaim Volozhin, once a year. And they would begin by asking about their families. You know, they would exchange personal news, what's new. And then they got into learning. That's the way I describe. I'm not reading it word by word, but that's the way I describe. He says, Chas v'chalila, they exchanged greetings. They asked about their families. They never spoke one word outside of Torah. What kind of apikousis is this? And that's what he said to Joe. He didn't have the guts to say it to me. And I can tell you, if you want to know the difference between 56 to 96, it's all in that story. So that's what I caution you. If you live in the world of 96 and you believe the latter version, Ribbono Shel Olam, you're going to have a lot of difficulties with understanding the real Rav. Go home, take out an art scroll book, cross out Rav Yaakov's name, cross out Rav Moshe's name, cross out Rav Simcha Wasserman's name, cross out this one's name, that one's name, put in Joseph B. Soloveitchik, and live happily ever after. I don't want to disturb you. If you have any intellectual honesty and you want to come back to 1956 when Baruch Hashem we were still normal, welcome to the class. And that story says it all. I told it to Tova. Tova almost had an epileptic. You know, Tova's mad at this Talmud, but anyway, that's a different story. Because he comes to Tova and he says, this is not to be repeated. You can't put this into writing. But he says to Tova, Tova, Rabbi, I heard from Rabbi Rakefet, you're a little angry at me. Tova says, I am. She says, you mispresent my father. So this Talmud is telling Tova, he says to her, listen, Tova, you know, you went in Aliyah, early 70s. You didn't know your father the last decade of his activity. I was very close to him. Your father was no longer a Zionist. So Tova couldn't contain herself. She says to him, let me tell you a little story. In the mid-70s, the Rav won an award in Israel. There was a prize given out by the president. I don't think it's given out today. They used to give out. I attended the first ceremony where Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin got. It was given to a great rabbi who did something very innovative. And I remember in the early 70s, I attended the ceremony. Shazar was still alive. He was like a Hasidic Rebbe at that time. He was an amazing president of the State of Israel. Shneur Zalman Shazar, he had returned to his youth, to his Chabad youth. And I was there when Shlomo Yosef Zevin, who inaugurated the Encyclopedia Talmudica, got the first award. The second time it was given to Rav Soloveitchik. At that point, Al HaTshuva appeared, and it was given in honor of the Al HaTshuva. And I forget what the sum was, but his children get a 10,000 lira check to give to the Rav. So Tova told me, she told this to this other student, she called her father and asked him what she should do with the check. Now, this is the mid-70s. It's almost as late as you could get where the Rav is still functioning. And the Rav said, take the check and give it to Merkaz Yeshiva B'nai Akiva. So that says it all. And that's the difference between 56 to 96. Okay, now let us begin. The Rav's life is very fascinating. It's very fascinating, forgetting about all the Torah involved, simply the world in which this man grew up, the world in which he functioned, there was so much color to his life. It's unique, because this is a man that grew up in Eastern Europe, spent very formative years in Western Europe, and completely became an American in the full sense of the word. There are few others. I don't know anyone else that we could say this about. You may talk about Reb Chaim Heller, but Reb Chaim Heller never conquered America. There's no one else I can speak of in this terms that united three totally different worlds. Now, the Reb's name, first of all, like anyone else, like any Jew, Jews have many different names. He's named after his great-grandfather, the Beit HaLevi. My grandson came home the other day and said, Sabu, I read about your Rebbe in some book in school in Chorev. And I said, you read about my Rebbe? He said, yes, we heard a beautiful story about Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. So I said, tell me the story. The minute he started the story, it was with Pesach, the guy that came and robbed from his house before Pesach, and he ran after him and gave him more money. If you're robbing already, you need money for matzah and wine. I said, it's not about my Rebbe, it's about his great-grandfather. So he's named Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. His family knew him as Beryl. In other words, evidently that was the name, Yosef Dov. Dov, of course, is bear. Dov means bear, and in Yiddish, bear is bear, and bear becomes Beryl, and that was the name that he was known by. I can tell you that because his wife, if you ever listen carefully, his wife would say to him, Beryl. And that was the name he was known by in the family, Beryl. Of course, once he went to Berlin, he became known Joseph B. Now, even the spelling of the last name is interesting. His father did not spell it with a T. For whatever the reasons are, the Rav insisted on spelling it with a T. And it's very interesting that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik spells it without a T, and the Rav spells it with a T. And whatever scholarship I've written on the Soloveitchik family until today, for the sake of argument, once I knew this, I don't know if it reflects itself in Revel. In my first book, I didn't know what I know today. In my second book, perhaps I didn't know. But I know when I did a monograph from Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, I was very pedantic, with a T, without a T, and I get a call from America, what are you doing to us? It's Soloveitchik, why a T, why not a T? And I had to explain to them that Rav Moshe wrote it without a T, Rav Aaron writes it without a T, the Rav writes it with a T, and one has to be pedantic. Now, the name Soloveitchik itself is interesting. Can anyone know what the name comes from? The name Soloveitchik means in Polish nightingale. How do we get to the name nightingale? Because the Soloveitchik family were Levium. What was the task of the Levium in the Beit HaMikdash? The task of the Levium was to sing. In order to sing, you have to have a nice voice. Nightingales have nice voices. That's how the Soloveitchik family, being Levium, took on the name nightingale, or took on the name Soloveitchik. And by the way, the Rav considered himself a shtickle of Baltvila. In other words, those of you that, I don't know if you know anymore, but maybe there's tradition in Boston, but the Rav had a fairly good voice, and he considered himself a bit of a Baltvila, a bit of a Balmanagin, a bit of a Soloveitchik, a bit of a Nightingale, a bit of a Levi. Of course, the Rav was born 1903, and you can put in, unfortunately I'm adding it now, the Rav died in 1993. As you all know, it's not really fair to say the Rav lived 90 years. This is a facet of modern life, that we keep people alive long after they stop functioning. So to say that he functioned 90 years, someone asked me, how long did your Rebbe live? I said, 90 years. He said, ugh, he was Zeichet Arichet Yamim. I said, not really. Because the truth of the matter is, by the time I would say he was 76 already, he was impaired. 76, 77, his functioning was no longer on his level, and by the time it was 1985, in other words, 82 already, he was practically on his way down Lo Aleinu, little more than a vegetable ultimately. But from the last 7-8 years of his life, he didn't function at all, and even before that, there was a tremendous diminishing of mental and intellectual ability. It was very sad. I would say until 79, which again is a Arichat Yamim. He had 76, 75 wonderful years. But, you know, in modern day and age, someone dies at 75, it's not that old. Someone dies at 90, but between 75 to 90, their prolificness was not there. Now, I don't have to tell you, the Soloveitchik family unites unbelievable yichus. Mitzad his father, when you just mention the name Soloveitchik, you start to shiver and shake. It goes all the way back to Reb Chaim Voloshin. I don't want to bore you with all the details, but Reb Chaim Voloshin was the Talmud Mufak of the Vilna Gaon and the founder of the first yeshiva in modern times. We did not have any modern yeshiva before Voloshin. Voloshin was founded in 1803. The reason we didn't have any modern yeshiva is simply everyone automatically went to the Beit Medrash, sat and learned in a haphazard, desolatory fashion. Every Rav was considered a Rosh Yeshiva, whether he knew how to speak, whether he didn't. But this was the reality of Torah learning before 1803. The reason Reb Chaim organized the Voloshin Yeshiva is that times were changing, winds were shifting, enlightenment was coming in, and you could no longer leave Torah learning to chance. And for the first time, you have a yeshiva with Rosh Yeshiva. Each one is a skilled pedagogue, students, gradations. And I have to tell you that to my great joy, a doctorate was just published that is as fresh can be. I'm one of the few people in the world already that's read the book from cover to cover. Tova showed me she just got a copy but has not picked it up yet. I couldn't put it down. Shaul Stampfer, an American boy whose father's a conservative rabbi in Milwaukee, if I'm not mistaken. Shaul Stampfer from the famous Stampfer family that founded Petach Tikva. His roots go back to the Talmidei Hagra. His roots go back to this very era. So Shaul came in Aliyah many years ago, did a doctorate at the Hebrew University on Lithuanian Yeshivat. And Merkaz Shazar, and in memory of the president, just published this volume. It's Yeshivat Litta Behit Havatam, something like that. It means the development of the Yeshivat in Lithuania. He has a major part of the book. It's about 200 pages. Is on Voloshin, something on Slabatka, and on Tells. It's a magnificent volume. I highly recommend you picking it up. You won't have time to study it this year because you're so busy with your Adayah, Rabbar and Sheyurim. But once you can go back to learning Torah with joy, which will be the year after this, I hope, put it aside, because learning Torah is a lifelong occupation, and learning about the history of Torah is what I would say the Rambam calls a mitzvah kala. It may not be as important as mitzvah as majoring Shas and Paiskim, but it helps you get a good framework if you know about Voloshin and Slabodka and Tells and what happened, our own history. Now, the Rav is a direct descendant of Chaim Voloshin. Rav Chaim Voloshin had a son-in-law, Rabbi Yosef Halevi Soloveitchik. He had a son, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Halevi Soloveitchik. He had a son, Galdomi Rabban Shemo, the great Beit Halevi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi, who's the first Soloveitchik to become Briska Rav, for whom the Rav is named. He had a son, Rabbi Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik, Galdomi Rabban Shemo, who, of course, Rabbi Chaim Briska. And Rabbi Chaim Briska had a son, Rabbi Moshe Halevi Soloveitchik. And, of course, out of Rabbi Moshe's marriage comes the Rav. Now, be aware that through his grandmother, Lifsha, Reb Chaim's wife, she was a granddaughter of the Netziv from Voloshin. So that Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the great Netziv of Voloshin, had a son-in-law, Reb Rafol Shapiro, Voloshin Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Rafol Voloshin, Reb Rafol Shapiro. Reb Rafol Shapiro had a daughter, Lifsha, who married Reb Chaim. So that the Rav's great-great-grandfather, or great-grandfather, figure it out, was the Netziv. So that whenever the Rav would speak about Reb Heschel Leib, you know, we were a kid, we used to the Rav say, my Nelta Zayda, Reb Heschel Leib, Reb Heschel Leib. Took me a long time to learn that Reb Heschel Leib is Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. You follow me? Reb Naftali Tzvi in Yiddish became Heschel Leib. So that was the Rav. I mean, yichus like this is hard to come by. Then on his mother's side, his mother was the daughter of Rebellia Feinstein, of course, was Pruzhana Rav, was the Pruzhana Rav, and Rebellia Feinstein was, of course, an uncle to Reb Moshe Feinstein, and Reb Moshe and the Rav's mother were first cousins. So that Rebetzin Pesha and Reb Moshe Feinstein were first cousins, meaning that the Rav was Reb Moshe Feinstein's first cousin once removed. Now, I don't have to tell you that he inherited a great deal from both sides of the family. The Rav spoke about it in many dramatic moments. I think some of those beautiful moments when he went into the family memoirs where he compared the Reb Chaim and his Zayde Reb Elia Plushiner, Reb Elia Feinstein. I don't want to go into great detail. In the course of time, we'll touch upon it. My book certainly has a great deal of material, and I think you know, at least the boys that studied with me last year, and certainly Avni knows, that the Rav's sister, who's no youngster herself, but Baruch Hashem is in perfect health and perfect mind, and she's in her mid-80s, Shulamit Meiselman from Brookline, her volume of family memoirs is at the bindery right now. I'm the only one in the state of Israel who has read the book from cover to cover, and I'm probably one of the few people in the world, because the publisher was kind enough to give me a pre-publication review copy, which was basically a Xerox of the book before it went to the bindery. So in that volume 2, you will find a great deal of information, and it's first-hand information, because Shulamit Meiselman came to America when she was about 19 years old, 18, 19 years old, so that she remembers Europe inside out. And she certainly knows and tells a great deal about the Feinstein family, because when all was said and done, that was the family that the Rav was much more intimate with, for very simple reasons. In those days, they didn't have a kollel yet. The whole concept of a kollel only begins, and you'll find it in Stampfer's book, it only begins in the late 1880s with Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and there's a little kollel in Kovna. But generally speaking, in those days, you had to marry the right girl. Today, fellas look around for a girl with a PhD. Papa has... No? I don't hear it. Papa has dough. That's a PhD. Today, in the yeshiva world, they look around for a girl with a PhD. Papa has dough. In those days, you looked around for a father who was willing to support you. And that's the way you went to kollel. You didn't go to a kollel, you were supported by the community. Mim gegeben geessen kest was the expression. So what happened was, when Reb Moshe married Pesha Feinstein, he went to live with his in-laws, and for something, you read Shulamit's book, I don't remember if it's 5 years or more, he just sat in his in-laws' house, sat and learned. In those days, there was no transportation like today. Today, you go back and forth from America, Israel, Israel, America, Israel, Russia. It's nothing with nothing. To go from here to England is quicker than to go from here to Haifa. There's less traffic jams up in the air than there are on the ground. So it's quicker to go from Jerusalem to England, to go to London, probably, than to go from here to Haifa. In those days, you didn't travel that much. The Rav basically only saw Reb Chaim a few times during his life. See, this is an amazing thing. The world thinks the Rav learned with Reb Chaim. It's not so. The Rav probably can count on the fingers of one hand, or perhaps two hands, how many times he actually saw Reb Chaim. You didn't get to Brisk so easily. He was born in Pruzhan, or Pruzhana. That's where Reb Elia was Rav. Those are his first memories. And in my book, I have quotes from the Rav, how he describes his early memories of Pruzhin or Pruzhana. And that's the very important influence, the Feinstein. Intellectually, there's no question that the Soloveitchik family, Reb Chaim, was the great Mechadesh, changed the whole way of Torah learning, was the great revolutionary. There's no question that the Soloveitchik family had the greatest intellectual influence on the Rav. From the point of view of personality, there's no question in my mind that it was the Feinstein family. The Feinsteins were very moderate. According to Shulamit Meiselman's description, Reb Elia himself already was a maskil, was open to the big world, and even if her description may not be totally accurate, I don't know, but there's no question about it that the Rav's mother was a maskila, that her rabbinit pesha was part of the big world, was favorable towards Zionism, read, studied on her own, was a Talmidah Chachama, knew Agada, and knew Nach, and knew Hebrew, and she was very much a part of the big world. Now, let me just say in parentheses, so that there should be no mistake about it, you fellas today are very fortunate, because you are born in a world where you can be in Torah and be in the Western world, and it comes so naturally that you never have to think twice. And it's not only YU.
When all is said and done, there's a big debate out there about YU.
And I'm not here to take sides. It could very well be, I just want to say to you, could very well be that YU's enemies are right, or YU's opponents, that you can't have a yeshiva and a college under one roof, and you can't have it. Imagine you have a university with a homosexual club. Could be they're right. I'm not taking sides. It's not important now what I think. I have my own opinion. It's not the opinion I just gave. But let's play the devil's advocate. It could be the world of Jewish observers correct, and Rabbi Chaim Dov Keller is right, himself a YU boy, and he throws the gauntlet down at Rabbi Lamb, shut down the university. Now they have to shut down Torah too, because Torah also has a homosexual club. You understand, when you live in America, as I said on Sunday, there is no need to wear clothes in America. Clothes is a sign of human dignity. America has lost all human dignity. The New York Times op-ed page functions on a level of a zoo. It's a zoo. This is the New York Times. Homosexuality, AIDS, freedom of choice, political correctness, sexual preference, alternate lifestyles. These are all terminologies that monkeys use. Apes use this. Gorillas use it. Bamboo, what do they call them? Baboons use it. You understand? Humans who believe in divine revelation, whether they're Jew or Christian, who have any part of the Judeo-Christian heritage, don't use this terminology. So in America, you know, it's a problem. You have a university, though. You have morons, homos, lowlives, AIDS advocates, the dope addicts, everybody shall lie, wife beaters, husband abusers. It's all part of society. This is it. Kol hamaber hareza meshubach. This is it. Political correctness, choice, freedom of choice. So, you see, maybe they're right. Maybe you can't have a yeshiva and a university in the one room. Maybe they're right. But let me tell you one thing. You go to an Agudat Yisrael convention, there are 2,500 people there. Out of the men, 80% are college graduates, lawyers, accountants, medical doctors, scientists. You have today, I'm listening via tape, some Professor Tversky from the Hasidic family, a dean of a Hofstra graduate school. And he talks, an expert in drug addiction and alcoholism, and he knows all the research. And today it's as natural as pardon me, in America, as having apple pie. You understand? When I see the first apple pie made in Israel, I'll realize that America has conquered Israel. So fine, if you see an apple pie, I'm waiting to see a blueberry pie. You understand? So in America, you eat blueberry pie and cherry pie and apple pie, and it's just as natural to go to college. There's no problem. It's in a wonderful world. You don't realize that. I'm talking about America now, not Israel. But the black world essentially is like the YU world. In that respect, 80% of the B'nai Torah go to college. And even among Hasidim today, you go into Touro College, their classes are filled with Hasidic Jews that are getting some sort of half a bachelor's, half a master's. Ribbono shel Olam, everyone is in on the act. And even in Lakewood, there are guys that go to college before Lakewood, after Lakewood. Everyone is in on the act today. 90, 100 years ago, you lived in a world where you could not walk so adroitly and so easily. There were two totally separate worlds. And generally speaking, if you became a maskil, you became an apikoros. If you became a Zionist, you became an apikoros. If you got involved with the big world, you became an apikoros. Voloshin in 1892, January 5th, January 22nd, Heshvat, I repeat, Heshvat, January 22nd, 1892, Voloshin actually closed its doors because it refused to introduce a few hours of secular study. The Russian government was insistent upon it. They could no longer bribe their way out. And they refused, and it's if refused, and they shut the yeshiva down. And this was the reality of Voloshin. In Slabodka, if they caught you with secular books, they threw you out of the yeshiva. The mashgiach went up and down. He couldn't care less whether you were learning, not learning. What they were checking, what did you have in your dorm room? What did you keep hidden under the Gemara? And chas v'chalila, they found a secular volume. You were butted out. The only place that had a little broad-mindedness was Telz. Telz was revolutionary, was different. The Rosh Yeshiva, Blazer Gordon, himself was a closet maskil, a closet Zionist. And there they had tremendous success. They had, for instance, students, you take Reb Simcha Saf, Had he been in any other yeshiva, he would have been lost to Torah Judaism. But he went to his Rebbe and tells him, said, I want to go to university. The Rebbe told him, all right, I see nothing can hold you back. Go to university, but become a great scholar, a great Jew. And he went on to become Professor Simcha Asaf, the greatest expert in Gaonic literature, a member of the Supreme Court, a Gaon, a Tzaddik, because in Telz, they didn't tell him you can't go. Had he been in Slabodka, had he been in Voloshin, if he would have gone to university, it would have broken all connections with his Rebbeim, with those that he held dear and near in the first period of his life. And there are other examples from Telz too, of people who managed to bridge two worlds, but Telz was considered different. So much so, that when Reb Moshe married Pesha, and this story is in Shulamit's volume, it's a Meiridik story, I heard it from the family, I never wanted to repeat it, but now that it's going to be published. When Reb Itzim Pesha married Reb Moshe, so Reb Chaim was opposed to inviting Reb Lezer Gordon, because he considered him an apikoros. He was the head of Telz. Telz already introduced classes with bechinat and gradations and marks and sheyurim. This was revolutionary. Until that time in yeshiva, hundreds of fellows sat and learned, attended one shir. And that wasn't even compulsory. And in Telz they had level Aleph, level Bet. There were five different levels and you had to pass exams and you had to go up and you were marked and they looked. And not only that, rumors had it that Reb Lezer Gordon was a Zionist, was a maskil, that he read Haskalah literature. So Reb Chaim didn't want to invite him. Reb Elyahu was caught in a bad spot because he was very friendly with Reb Lezer Gordon. So it turns out that Reb Lezer Gordon came to the wedding anyway. He heard they're making a wedding in those days. You wouldn't like today. You didn't have to get an invitation. Your friend is making a wedding. Kamsa ba kamsa. You know the musavot. What's ba kamsa at fault? If he knew his friend was making a simcha, he should have come even without an invitation. So Reb Lezer Gordon showed up anyway. When Reb Lezer Gordon showed up, Reb Elyahu said to Reb Chaim, the Telzer HaShashiv is there. I have to give him Siddur Kedushin. I have no choice. He's the most famous Lamdan present. He was a great Lamdan. So Reb Chaim Bal Kochi Yaneh Amein and Reb Lezer Gordon with Siddur Kedushin when Pesha married Reb Moshe. Now, there's no question there was tension between them on this level, and the family stories are now going to be washed in public. Shulamit Meisman has it all. There's no question that Reb Moshe was opposed to the secular world, secular studies, Haskalah, Zionism. There's no question that Pesha was exactly the opposite, and like any good wife, slowly but surely, she gave her husband her opinion. And we'll come back to that later, because that's a very important point in understanding Rav Soloveitchik and his development. Okay, so here he is, born into this house, having this tremendous background. And I have to tell you honestly, and I think you can all appreciate this, it's not easy to be a Soloveitchik. Being born into a family like this immediately puts a burden on you. And you'll see it in Shulamit's memories, the difference between the Rav, his younger brother, Rav Shmuel Yaakov, who was my chemistry professor, Zichrono Livracha. It's a tremendous burden. I don't envy, if I can just tell you one anecdote, again, that says it all. If you want to understand what it means to be a Soloveitchik, that happened to me. And this story you'll never forget. And one little story says it all. I was a kid younger than you. In my days, you got smicha earlier. Smicha was only 2 years. We didn't have a kollel. I was the last Rebbe appointed. I told you I'm a footnote to history. The last Rebbe appointed to the YU, your Reitz faculty, who was never in a kollel. There's no kollel. You had to learn. If you didn't know how to learn by the time you were 19, forget it. They locked you in a closet and threw the... My classmate was Chaim Soloveitchik. For one moment, I'm going to ask you to do something that is not too aesthetic. Look at my nose. Look at my nose. Have you ever seen pictures of the Rav? Look at the pictures of the Rav's nose. Look at Chaim Soloveitchik's nose. Now, here I am at a wedding. This is B'didi Havayov. That happened to me. I'm at a wedding, and the dean of the yeshiva was Dean Shmuel Leib Zah, the famous Dean Zah, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Now, Dean Zah was then in his 60s, a world-class act. And suddenly, Dean Zah comes over to me, and this is the American weddings. I don't know today what goes on in a wedding, but there's a smorgasbord, you know, before the wedding. An American wedding, you eat enough for a whole week for a normal person. So there's a smorgasbord. And at the smorgasbord, Dean Zar comes over to me and says, what can I get you to eat? And he starts bringing me food. And I can't understand what's going on. I'm all of 21, 22 years old. This man is in his 60s. I'm a little Arnie Rothkopf, a garbage can. He's the king of the world. And then he says to me, Chaim, is there anything else I can get you? Did I sneak away? And I realized the true story. I realized he mistook me for Chaim Soloveitchik. The truth was, I was slightly taller than Chaim. Our faces were basically the same. The nose was there. Glasses were there. He mistook me for Chaim Soloveitchik. And then I realized the burden. Baruch Hashem, my last name is Rothkopf, not Soloveitchik. It's a burden. Don't minimize it. So being born into this family with so much background, so much heritage. Now, the first and one of the most far-reaching influences in the Rav's life, and all of you are familiar with the story. The Rav told the story. Maybe I heard it from him in person and via tape. I wouldn't say much. I heard it from him 50 times. Once in a while, he contradicted himself on some of the minor points, but the story was essentially the same. His earliest years were in Pruzhana, Pruzhin. Afterwards, his father has to go into the rabbinate. There are already a few children born, and Shulamit writes about it. And, you know, when there are a few children born, there's a limit how much in-laws can support. At a certain point, you got to go out on your own. So his father goes to one community, Raisin. From there, he goes to the community where the Rav already comes into his own. He starts having growing up. And that, of course, is Chaslavich. Now, and Rav Moshe remains in Chaslavich until basically the conclusion of World War I. Now, Chaslavich was a white Russian town that was filled with Chabatnikim. Immediately, you have to ask yourself the question, why did a Chabad community choose a Litvisher Rav? And this is a very important question. And the Rav often told the story. The answer is very simple. During the Napoleonic Wars in the 1810s, the Alter Rebbe was running away from Napoleon's armies, the first Chabad Rebbe. The Chabad Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe, the Baal Tanya, opposed Napoleon. Because he felt as bad as things are for the Jews in France, if Chas v'Chalila, Napoleon wins, as bad as things are for the Jews in Russia, rerun the tape, cross out France, as bad as life is in Russia, the Jews are persecuted, better that Russia should win, not Napoleon. Because France will enlighten the Jews and take them out of a Torah lifestyle. So the Alter Rebbe not only fought Napoleon, he had Hasidim who were spies for the Russians. Hasidim who knew French and were spies. Napoleon's army had an order to kill the Rebbe. The Rebbe was running away, comes to Chaslavich, and the Rav of the town was a mitnaget. The Rebbe asked the Rav to hide him. The Hasidim said to the Rebbe, what are you, crazy? This guy's a mitnaget, he hates Hasidim. And the Alter Rebbe said, the Rav is not going to be moser on me. He's not going to give me away. And the Rav of the town hid the Alter Rebbe and saved him. From that time on, they made a gezeirah in this town, or takana, that every Rav has to be a mitnaged. The Soloveitchik family was very favorably disposed to Hasidut. Reb Chaim already used to send his kids and bris to the Kollel Stolen Shtibble to Davin, and they were and Reb Velvel did that. They were very favorably disposed, so that Reb Moshe was a natural for this position. He was a Litvak, a Lamdin, a Mitnaged, and favorably disposed to Chassidut. And of course, the Rav comes to Chaslavich, and Reb Moshe sends him to Cheder. Reb Moshe sends him to Cheder. The Rav is about 8 years old, and it's the famous story how he goes to Cheder, he has this Chabad Rebbe, and he goes every day, and he's learning in Cheder, and his mother senses he is not making any progress. So their versions of the story, probably the best version is they went to a family wedding, a family simcha, and Reb Chaim was at the simcha, and the mother goes over to Reb Chaim, give your grandson a bechina.
Sar Rav Chaim calls over this little barrel and he says, Nu Yingel, was kennt ihr? Was war, how many of you know Yiddish? I found one girl in Midrashit that knows Yiddish this year. With one girl I can talk Mama Lashon. So Reb Chaim calls over his grandson and says, what do you know? What are you learning? So the kid says, I'm learning Bab Metzia. HaSeicher Sa'umnin. See, the Rav also said in later years it was Meruba in Baba Kama. And I was corrected. I spoke at the Yoyu conventions to Rabbi Ganek. Says, no, Rabbi Rakefet, you're wrong. I said, I'm wrong? The tape is wrong. The Rav contradicted himself, and he went back and heard the tape. He said, you know, you're right, but it's a contradiction, because over the years, we always heard a Sochet Umnin. Yes, Rabbi Lichtenstein, he also wrote a Sochet Umnin. Could be he learned two different Prakim. Could be, or could be just in his old age, he simply slipped. Could be. But anyway, the Rav doesn't know one word of a Sochet Umnin. So Reb Chaim gets angry, and he says, Was kennt ihr ja? What do you know? And the Rav begins, Tanya, Bishali Perikimul Denida, Mashmiro Tete Tzadik, Vialte Hei Rasha. That's the way the Tanya begins. And the Rav starts giving him the Tanya Valter. And as the Rav said, I knew very little of Aseiches Umnin. He says, my Rebbe knew even less than I did that year. But I see you're having so much enough from the Shia, sit close, it's easier, you have no idea. Jack will tell you, he heard me teach yesterday, and he left after one half of my teaching, and he couldn't believe I was going to repeat that 2-hour class again to another class, and, you know, he said to me, how do you do it? And God should give us strength. I look back how I taught until 10 years ago, I faint just thinking about it, so God give us strength. So, you'll hear a paper, I don't know if this year, next year, the third year, you'll hear a paper the Rav gave at Rabbi Riskin's shul. Only once did the Rav ever speak at Lincoln Square Synagogue. And the Rav gave a paper on this Chabad Rebbe. I have in my book a lot of material. What you'll be able to read it. I can't spend the whole year just on the biography part. But I want to tell you, why was this so important? Why did the Rav, till his very last days, when his mind functioned, he said, I am so thankful to that Chabad Rebbe. I am so thankful. Why? What was involved here? And I'll tell you why. That Chabad Rebbe opened the Rav to the whole world of philosophy. Let's understand something. Tanya is a philosophic work. Tanya deals with very real problems. If you've studied Tanya for the sake of argument, Tzadikim, Rishayim, Beinoniyim, these are philosophic problems. The relationship between a Rebbe and a Chassid, a Rebbe and a Talmud. How did God make the world? Tzimtzum. How does God relate to the world? These are philosophic problems. And whether you accept the Baal Tanya's answers or not is unimportant. What it did to this 8-year-old kid, it opened his mind that there's a whole world of philosophy out there. And the Rebbe said, and I quote him, that all his drushes and all the agada and all his innovativeness, it all goes back on that level, in the level of machshava, hashkafa, philosophy, theology, even the tshuva drasha. Take what you want. This all goes back to the Chabad Rebbe. The Rebbe said, had I not studied with that Rebbe, my mind would have never been open to this aspect of Torah. And that's why the Rav used to say, Ich bin azay dankbar. I'm so thankful. You know, the Rav had a wonderful sense of humor. He said, Gemara, he didn't teach me. Et nicht verstanden. Ich hab nicht. He didn't understand it. I didn't understand it. But he taught me a great deal. He opened my eyes. And the truth of the matter is that when the Rav, and you have to understand this, what I'm about to say, and it was said first by Gilbert Klapperman, or said first by Ron Lichtenstein, I don't know who's quoting who, but I'm quoting both of them. But it's very important. Reb Moshe, Reb Chaim, never held the Maron Avuchim in their hand. You're talking about Reb Chaim Brisker that knew the Mishnah Torah backwards and forwards, inside and out. There's no greater machadesh on the Mishnah Torah since the Mishnah Torah was written than Reb Chaim Brisker. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik knew the Mishnah Torah backwards and forwards. Neither of them ever held the Maron Avuchim in their hands. You know the story with the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim comes into the Beis Medrash, and his son Reb Aaron, who yet made it to America. You should know the Chafetz Chaim's widow. You know where she's buried? Buried in the United States, Mount Judah Cemetery, right between Queens and Brooklyn. People faint. I discovered it. My student took me. Who's great? It's the Chafetz Chaim. She survived World War II. She got to America. She got to America in 1940. With her son-in-law, with her son. She's buried there. His son is buried there. And so the story was his son. He had one son. His son was sitting and learning Moreh Nevuchim. Chafetz Chaim walked in, saw his son learning. He slammed it shut. So the son said, Tata, what are you doing? This is the Rambam. This is the one, the same Rambam who wrote the Mishnah Torah, wrote the Moreh Nevuchim. So the Chafetz Chaim man said, yes. He wrote it for those people who have no fathers. You have a father. You don't need the Moreh Nevuchim. And that was the attitude. Do you understand? The Rav knew the Moreh Nevuchim as well as he knew the Mishnah Torah. Inside out, both Svarim. And he quoted them indiscriminately. You understand? In all his drasha and all his talks. I don't know, of course, he quoted the Rambam and all his halachic talks. But in his hashkafic talks, his Haggadah, his drasha, his philosophy, 1,000 times over, he quoted the Moreh Nevuchim. And that you have to go back to that Chabad Rebbe, to Reb Baruch. His name was Reb Baruch, and that was a tremendous influence in his life. Now I tell you by way of passing that this is an unbelievable little anecdote. The person who's involved lives a few blocks from here in Beit Vagan. As you all know or should know, the Israeli government ran a tremendous underground movement into Russia, beginning with 1967, when relations were broken. By late 67 already, I think already by Hanukkah, certainly by 68, Israel started sending Jews into Russia from all over the world on foreign passports. In the early 70s, a fellow was sent from YU. His name is Menachem Kasdan, Rabbi Menachem Kasdan. Then it was your age. And he goes to Russia for the Israeli government under the web of B'nai Akiva. It's an entire story. It's not for now. He comes into Moscow, and you were under orders how to present yourself, who to contact. And in the great synagogue in Moscow, he lets it be known that he's a student of Reb Yosher Ber Soloveitchik at Yeshiva University. The next day, comes back to the great synagogue, and from the shtibel on the side, a tall, skinny man in his 80s comes out, and he calls this fellow over. He says, I heard that you're a student of Reb Yosher Ber. He says, yes. He starts asking about him, and then he tells him, when you go back, bring him on a grus from Reb Baruch. And my student says, which Reb Baruch? He says, you bet them, Reb Baruch from Chaslovich. That'll be enough. The guy comes back, and this is the early 70s. I have this all in my book, by the way, every word documented. And the Rav, you know, when the Rav finished here already, I don't have to tell you, in Vet Delta, you grow older, your energies ebb. You're young, enjoy your youth. Smach bachur b'yaldutecha. But be aware, you grow older. Halavai, you should all grow older. You understand what I'm saying? So the Rebbe finished shiur. This was after he was a broken man already, a mellowed man, and he would slump. He finished a 3-hour shiur. He was exhausted, and fellas always bothered him. They had no mercy on him. So Menachem says, Rebbe, I have regards from you. What the Rebbe? You have regards. You know how many people sent the Rebbe regards? We banish regards, so we have regards. Okay, face Ani Rothkopf and big deal. So he says, Rebbe, I have regards from Vemin. You know the Rebbe's like, from Reb Baruch, from Chaslovich. The Rav jumps up like a lion. He says, Sikanish sign, what do you think can't be? He says, Rebbe, I was just in Moscow. The Rav says, it can't be. How old is he? He says, Rebbe, tell me, did I just tell you his name? Did I just say to you, Reb Baruch? The Rav said, yes. Rebbe, whenever you told us the story, did you ever tell us his name? The Rav said, no. How do I know his name? And the Rav got all excited. And whenever he told the story afterwards of Reb Baruch, he would always say, and I have a, don't think, I have a student who just visited, and he saw him. He's still alive. He survived the Holocaust. He died in the late 70s. He died in his late 80s. That was the Rebbe's Rebbe. See, very real, and there's a living connection. Menachem Kasten lives a few blocks from here in Bayit Vagan. He may even come into the Beit Medrash. I don't even know. Ask. I know in previous years he would come in and learn. You ask him to verify every word I said. Okay, so this was the first influence on the Rebbe's life. A very important influence tied together with the Meron Avuchim, and you'll understand why we're sitting here and why the Rebbe was so different and why the Rebbe was unique. And we have to deal with 1956. Intellectual honesty. This was the Rebbe. Rabbi Moshe did not know the Meron Avuchim. Rabbi Yaakov did not know the Meron Avuchim. Rabbi Heschel Shechter does not know the Meron Avuchim. Rabbi Barbara Banshpiegel does not know the Meron Avuchim. You understand what I'm saying? But this was the Rav. He was different. You have to understand that right away. He had so many students, but this is a basic part of his gestalt. One. Two. At this point, you see what's happening, Jack. Because of my book and all my research, it's going to take me much longer just to do the Rav's life, and I have to do the life just so the boys should be able to put the Rav into context. Two. Reb Chaim called Reb Moshe Rova, and he took his son, and he said, "You have a son that has genius ability, but if you're going to let him out of your hands, he's going to be lost. And I order you that you have to study with him." So what would happen is as follows. Beginning with the age of 8, until the Rav already was practically in his 20s, in other words, they left Chaslovich until the Rav was 17, 18. He went to Cheder, would come home. Rav Moshe would finish up his activities for the community, whatever he had to do as Rav. They would go back to the Beis Medrash, and they remained there to 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, learning together. And this is why the Rav always said, "I had only one Rebbe in my life. The Welt macht atoyes," and I'll come to it later. The world makes a mistake. They think I had a second Rebbe. It's not true. I had only one Rebbe. My father was the only Rebbe I ever had. Now, the Rav gave very moving descriptions. He said that his mother, Pesha, used to say, the Vilna Gaon, when he eulogized his wife, and he got up and said, "Gentlemen, it's impossible to teach Torah without speaking Yiddish. I don't know where you were raised. I don't know what kind of Torah you received. But in Lakewood, they told me that Moshe Rabbeinu got the Torah in Yiddish, and they were right. It's one of the few things they told me in Lakewood where they were absolutely, totally right." Darn it. To break my teeth there in translation. I'm not Art Scroll. Torah Dachm Fashtein in Mama Lashem. The Vilna Gaon got up and eulogized his wife. "See, the Litten Mer for me, she suffered more than I did. Because she not only suffered hunger like I did, she suffered from the lack of heat as well." What did he mean? The Vilna Gaon was so poor, he just learned Torah day and night. He went to the Beis Medrash. The Beis Medrash was heated. She remained at home. At home, they were both hungry, but there was also no heat. He at least had heat in the Beis Medrash. The Rav said that that's exactly the way his mother should be eulogized. She suffered more than he and his father, because they left the house, went to the Beis Medrash. There was light, there was heat. It was the Beis Medrash of the community. He said, "You didn't want to come home. Sometimes they would come home as late as 1, 2 o'clock at night. You didn't want to come home." And he said about his mother. His mother said that you should eulogize me the way the Vilna Gaon eulogized his wife. She remained at home. Remember, and understand this. You know why this is very important to understand the Rav? Because you'll understand why he loves America, why he appreciates America. Try to understand the poverty in which Jews lived, in which Reb Moshe Soloveitchik lived, in which my Rebbe, Reb Yosher Ber, was raised. Try to understand the poverty. Understand? This gives you insight. What the Rav once said, I heard with my own ears in Tisha B'Av in 78 when I was in Boston. So the Rav said, "When I was a little boy, I dreamt about having a ball." He said, "That ball was as distant from me as the Chinaman on the moon." Something to that effect. I have it in my book as well. He said, "I finally had to take paper and old newsprint and use glue and bind it together. That's the way I made myself a ball." So that the Rav describes so movingly, but his father became his chavruta, his study mate, and through his father, he mastered all of Brisk. The Rav was very innovative. And already as a teenager, he started being Machadish on the Rambam. He wrote it in a notebook. That's the famous story I'm about to tell you. Reb Chaim, Reb Moshe sent Reb Chaim a copy of the notebook. Reb Chaim got the notebook of his grandson's Chidushim, yet a teenager, and he ran ecstatically with joy into the home of the Briska Dayan, Reb Simcha Zelik Riga. I repeat, Reb Simcha Zelik Riga, the Briska Dayan, the famous Briska Dayan, and he was ecstatic. Reb Chaim said, "This is my grandson's Chidushim. He's going to be the giant of giants of the next generation." Now, I can give you an exact list of what the Rav studied with his father. I'm the first person in the world to make this list available. Now, you wonder how I have it? Tovra Aaron looked at me. How do you have this? Answer is very simple. The 1970 Yahrzeit Shir, the Rav ad-libbed, and he started talking about his relationship with his father and what it means. Rebbe Muvhak was very important for the Shir to define the concept of Rebbe Muvhak. And he started listing everything he studied with his father. That Shir was later published by Shirim Lezecha Abba Mari by Machon Yerushalayim. However, they published it from manuscript. Since they published it from manuscript, the list was not there. This was ad-libbed. So that anyone who didn't pay attention to the tape doesn't have the list. So the Shir is published, but the whole paragraph, the whole 15 minutes where he ad-libbed and described the relationship and described what they studied together, all that is lacking. And yours truly uncovered it from the tape. And let me tell you what he studied with his father. The three Bavot, Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Batra, Sanhedrin, Shvuot, Makot, Gittin, Kedushin, Nedarim, Nazir, Saita, Zvachim, Menachat, Me'ila, Bechorat, Tamura, Kalim, Ohalat, Yadayim, Brachat, Peya, Trumat, Maisa Sheini, and Bikurim. So that, take a look. It's not all of Shas, but it's a good portion of Shas. I don't even know if it's half of Shas. May not even be half, but a good portion. He got the Yesodot. He got the Derech. These are the Masechtot. Imagine how the Rav could list it, and he relived it. In 1970, you could see him thinking. You could just hear him. I heard him via tape. But yeah, he was thinking, Vasnach, Vasnach, what else, what else? And this is the exact list. I can tell you also, when I said Bechora Tamura, when I originally published this list, I published it incorrectly. I had down Kenim instead of Tamura. So Stephen, you'll ask, how do I know that it's Kenim, that Kenim is out, Tamura is in? And here too I have a story. How do I know? You see, when the Rav was being recorded, whenever he turned away from the microphone or spoke quickly, it slurred. And it's very hard to pick up. Two of my admirers from who live partially here, partially in the States, bought me a special gift. It is a very sophisticated, a little tape recorder. It's Pesach HaKol, not much larger, if at all, than this. It's a professional piece of work. It's worth a fortune of money, a Japanese piece, of course. I have the ability to take a tape and slow it down. I can play with the tone. What I can do to a tape, I can take a tape that you can't make out clearly on an ordinary machine such as this, which is a good machine already, and I put it on this little gizmo, and lo and behold, I was going out of my mind because I had written Kenim, but something bothered me when I heard the tape again. It's not so clear, not so clear, not so clear. I played with this machine, and I listened 20 times, and each time when I slowed it down to nothing, it was Tamura, not Kenim. And you know what's funny? When I made the correction with tradition, because I have an article coming out in tradition, it should only appear soon, on the Rav's early life, so Rav Menachem Benak told me this summer that when I set in the original list,
He was troubled. Why?
Why Kinnam? He said he could never recall the Rav saying he learned Kinnam with his father. So he said, when you made the correction to Temura, I felt much better. And Menachem Benek, by the way, very close to the Rav, not just as a Talmud, he was basically like the Rav's son, of course, of family reasons. And if you remind me, when I talk about Berlin, I can explain that to you. Now, so you have two tremendous influences on the Rav. You have the influence of this Chabad Rebbe, that leads all the way to Meron of Luchim, opens up the whole world of Machshava, philosophy, theology, Drush. What made the Rav so different, what made the Rav so unique, and what made the Rav so attractive to people like myself that wanted more than just the narrow confines of Lakewood. That's the Chabad Rebbe. And that explains also why the Rav always had a positive attitude towards Chassidut, towards Chabad. There was always a positive attitude towards Chassidus in general, and to Chabad Bifrat. Okay, this explains it. Number two, you can understand the influence of his father, Reb Chaim, the Brisket Derech. Imagine to sit with your father, a Gadol B'Yisrael, have a private Rebbe, and to master all these Masechtot. Now, that's very rare, because you see, no father can have that time, no son. I know my grandchildren are growing older. You have to make an appointment to see them. They're busy with school. They're busy with school. I would love to learn with my grandchildren. All summer I learned till I went to America. I kept those guys busy every day. But now they're busy with school. You barely see them. And when you see them, I'm exhausted. They're exhausted. You know, you can't start pressing them beyond their homework and what they have to do to survive. And here, due to the exigencies of life in Europe, you have a father who could finish up his rabbanut. Because in those days, the rabbinate allowed time for a rabbi to learn. The American rabbinate today, if they catch a rabbi learning, the congregation fires him. Goes without saying, an American rabbi, it's sine qua non requirement, no time for learning. I just met one of the biggest rabbanim, is a dear student of mine, I don't want to mention his name. I said, do you learn? Has my picture on his desk. I'd be happy if instead of my picture, he had the svarim on the desk. You understand what I'm saying? Okay, but he's a dear student. He says, no, he has no time. I told him the only way. I saw this in the army. The General Gad Navon, you know, I saw this with my own eyes. He comes to his office 7 o'clock. From 7 to 9, he cannot be disturbed. His secretaries know, his Rosh Lishkan, Ralash knows, everyone knows. You cannot disturb him unless it's life and death, unless the Prime Minister wants him or something like that. He sits and learns. The first 2 hours a day, he simply sits and learns. And that's the only way a Rav can survive. And Rav Moshe in the European rabbinate, fine, you took care of your responsibilities to the city, whatever it was, there was some Dinei Torah, this, that. But by 2 o'clock, you were free to sit and learn. And imagine to be able to sit and learn with your son. Okay. So this is the second influence, and the most important influence, the most basic influence when all is said and done. My Rebbe is the heir to Brisk more than anything else. Now we have to come back to his mother. And here we come to the third influence. And of course, she opens the world of secularism, Haskalah, Zionism, literature. She was a very well-read woman. Now, the right wing totally blames Rebbetzin Pesha. They maledict her, curse her out. Is she totally to blame? What was Rav Moshe's attitude? My own research and Shulamit's volume sort of complement each other. And I would say as follows. When you read Shulamit's volume, and again, all the dirty linens are washed in public in a nice way. I think it's very important. I'm not saying this in a critical sense because the volume is magnificent because it shows real people. It's not an art scroll volume that from the time the Rebbe was 3 days old, he was learning day and night, he was at Tzadik Yisod Olam, he libo chashka b'torah, he had only one dream to teach Torah in Yeshiva University, to raise 1 million students. It's not that type of volume. It's an honest volume, real people. You follow me, Moshe? That you can see. Gedolei Yisrael, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and Pesha fought bitterly over this approach to secular world. Slowly but surely, Rav Moshe started to see that Pesha is right. Now, Shulamit tells a story in the book, and I'll tell you my question on the story. She finally has to deal with the question, how did Rav Moshe acquiesce that Rabbi Yosher Ber should study secular subjects. Here he was so opposed, and when they first married, he ran away home, he ran back to his father. Mamish ran back to his father. Was so upset, his wife was discussing Tolstoy and Pushkin. And what finally happened? So Shulamit writes that finally Rebbe Zimpesha said to him, what do you think? You think you're influencing your son not to study? And she takes him into Yosher Ber's room and shows him hidden away are the Haskalah books. When Rebbe Moshe saw that, he gave in and said, all right, if he's going to study secretly, let him study publicly. That's the story that Shulamit tells. I have a feeling that Rebbe Zimpesha hid the books there and showed it to him and gave him his opinion after many years of debate between them. But there's no question that Rebbe Moshe, by the time the Rebbe's a teenager, Rebbe Moshe does not oppose his being involved with secular study as well. There's no question in my mind. And I'll prove it in a few minutes. You all know that following World War I, Rebbe Moshe attempts to go back to Volozhin. They're going to reorganize it, and he goes back, and the family throws him out. They don't need him around. It's all types of family politics. Because remember, Litvish yeshiva are family-owned. This is a Litvish tradition. You fellas grew up in YU. The greatest compliment I can pay to YU is that it's a public trust. And that Aaron Rakefet can teach in YU, even though his name is Rakefet, it's not or Rothkopf, it's not Soloveitchik, and it's not Feinstein, and I didn't marry a girl with a PhD, and my wife is not related to anyone with Begiches in YU. I can teach in YU. It's a great compliment to YU. In YU, you can rise to the top on the basis of your own abilities. I don't know of any Rosh Yeshiva, and you have wonderful, wonderful Rosh Yeshiva. I don't know one Rosh Yeshiva who's married to Rabbi Belkin's daughter, to Rabbi Soloveitchik's daughter. Rabbi Lichtenstein was Rabbaran on his own. Marrying Tova was incidental, if you understand what I'm saying. Rabban was already ashamed of it when the kid came into the yeshiva. I once saw his application. He applied to YU. He graduated high school at 14. He then sat 2 years in the Chaim Berlin Beis Medrash. At 16, he applies to YU, Yeshiva College, which he finished in 3 years. And in the application, a little print, what did you do last year? So he writes a little print. For the last 2 years, I sat in the Chaim Berlin Beis Medrash, and I studied and completed Shas. That's Rabbi Lichtenstein at the age of 16. And all of you know, he remembered every word and every daf and every amid. So he didn't marry the right girl. Marrying Tova was incidental. That's a different story. But any Rebbe can rise to the top, and that's why he was a public trust. So Rebbe Moshe tries to go to Volozhin, they're trying to reopen it. I don't want to go into details, which I know the details, but it'll take me far abreast. The Welkin family has it now. It comes from Rebbe Fol Shapiro with sons-in-law, grandchildren. And then Rebbe Moshe goes to Mizrahi, to the Tach Kamoni in Warsaw. And the world is shaking. Shlomit writes this. I just love every word. And the old-time Talmidim of Rebbe Chaim come in to give him Musa, to tell him off. To bow breed him, to put him down. How dare you go? What happened to you? A Mizrachiite, a Maskil. And he gets hysterical, and he, Rav Moshe, who had a real temper, I yet knew the Rav's temper. After reading Shulamit's book, I know where he got his temper from. Rav Moshe gets hysterical and says, you lowlights, you dogs, get the hell out of here. When I went to Volozhin, you didn't help me. I'm starving. I had no bread. World War I. Where were you? Now I have a chance to put bread on my table, and you're giving me Musa, and he threw them out of the house in anger. Of course, every Rosh Hashanah he apologized. But by that time already, Rebbe Moshe is a different type of person. And this will explain to you why he could come to America. Once already you've crossed the threshold, and your son already, who's a Gadol B'Torah, is learning secular studies, and you're teaching in a Mizrahi institution. So by that point already, the treif in the land, the treif land of America that the Ritbaz said when he visited America, I quote to you from the Rakafet Aharon now, the Ritbaz said, in America even the stones are treif, you understand? You know, stones that you use the kasha with, you throw a burning hot stone into a pot, even the stones are treif. But once Reb Moshe already is involved, his son already is in Berlin, he's at Tach Kamoni, then America is not so treif anymore. Now, The Rav's mother arranges for private tutors, and the Rav masters, first of all, German, in addition, basic courses in mathematics, takes all the external exams, and gets a high school equivalency degree. Now, what I'm telling you now is not exactly absolutely correct. We cannot prove it, and I'll tell you what the problem is. And here we come to problems of scholarship. And listen to me carefully. Rabbaron Lichtenstein was the first one to write a biography on the Rav. He published it in the B'nai B'rith series of great thinkers of the 20th century, great Jewish thinkers. It appeared about 34, 33 years ago. I took for granted every word in that biography has to be correct. I took for granted for one reason, the Rav was in his prime. And I figured if you write something that's incorrect, the Rav would chop your head off. In addition, it's Rabbi Lichtenstein writing the biography, not a guy on the moon, it's the Rav's son-in-law. It happened that whatever was in Rabban's article, I copied. If you're familiar with the article in the Judaica, you'll look at the name of the person that wrote it. It says A period, R-O period. That happens to stand for Aaron Rothkopf. He was a good friend of mine while he was alive. He disappeared in 68, 69. He disappeared and Aaron Rakefa took his place. So I wrote that article, and I depended upon Aaron. I figured, look, I'm standing on the shoulders of a giant. I have nothing to worry about. If you're familiar, about a year ago, Manfred Lehman, this is Dr. Manfred Lehman, who's a very wealthy individual, but most people, not, I'm one of the few people in the world that you will ever meet that's happy doing what he's doing. I'm very happy. I had three desires in my life, to be a Gaon, a Tzaddik, and a Rebbe. I never became a Gaon, I never became a Tzaddik, but at least I became a Malamed, I became a Rebbe. Most people are not happy. Rabbis become doctors. Doctors become rabbis. Rabbi Tendler has a son-in-law, Dr. Yaakov Tendler, I believe his name is. I know him. He's married to a student of mine. He's a frustrated rabbi, just like his father's a frustrated doctor. You understand? Every generation goes back and forth. No one is happy with what they're doing. So now Manfred Lehman, who's a multimillionaire, he is a scholar. And he uncovered documents at the University of Berlin. Now, a student of mine tells me, Mark Shea, he tells me, he uncovered the documents, he gave them to Manfred Lehman, but I have to give Manfred Lehman the credit because he published them. And unless my student can prove otherwise, I have to cite Manfred Lehman, not my student. So Manfred Lehman published these documents. It's in the Rav's own handwriting. And when the Rav wanted to get into the University of Berlin, he writes a whole biography, and he writes that he attended the Dubno Jewish High School. Now, Dubno's a place in Poland. I check with the family, Shulamit Meiselman, Rabban Soloveitchik. I mean, there are not many people that can know this. They swear that the Rav never left Chaslovich, went to Warsaw. It's impossible he never went to Dubno. What I think happened is very simple, that the external exams and the degree were arranged through Dubno High School. Evidently, Rav Moshe had a Talmud, or there was some Voloshin. You know, there are many people who learned in their youth in Voloshin, who are part and close to the Soloveitchik family. Some of them became maskilim. This person evidently wound up the principal of Dubno, and he arranged with Rav Moshe, fine, we'll take care of your son, we'll arrange for him to get the degree through our institution once he passes the exams. That's the only way I can solve this problem, because the Rav writes in his own handwriting, Dubno High School. I don't believe it would be totally untrue. In other words, the Rav is writing Mesiach Lefi Tumo to get into the University of Berlin. Of course, he has to show he went to high school. But how did he get this degree? Everyone knows the Rav never spent a day in Dubno. So that's the way I interpret it. Now, I asked Rabaron, I asked Tova, this article, because there are more mistakes, as you'll see in a minute. Very important mistakes. Did the Rav read it? So Aaron Lichtenstein doesn't forget anything, doesn't remember. Where did you get the details? Doesn't remember. He says they were in the lufts. And you know, we all knew it was in the air. We used that expression. It was in the air. We all knew this. Tova says to my father, was unimportant, the anonymous man. You'll hear a whole gesture from me 2 years from now, whatever it is, on the anonymous man. I said, Tova, please, don't give me the anonymous man. I know that gesture as well as you do or better. I just reconstructed for the Kollel. But history has to be written history. Anyway, I stand corrected, and I put in Dubno, and in my book, you'll see, it's a whole footnote. but more than that. And this is crucially important. The world likes you to think that when the Rav went to Berlin, his mother was pushing him and his father was crying. This Manfred Lehman uncovered that while the Rav was in Warsaw, he attended the Polish, the Free University. And I couldn't believe my eyes. While the Rav was in Warsaw, he already was taking courses in political science. I asked Aaron, you don't have a word of it. He said he didn't know. I checked, absolutely validated, both by Shulamit Meiselman and both by Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik Shlita. Now, you know what this means? In Warsaw, there were two universities. A private university where Jews were not accepted, and a public university for poor people where there were thousands of Jewish students. That's where the Rav went. Do you know why this information is so important? Can anyone tell me why? What does it show you? That the Rav attended higher secular education while still in his father's house. If his father would have disapproved, this could have never happened. So please, by this time, Steve, don't just blame his mother. Blame the father as well. And now you can understand there's a logical progression here. By 1925/26, the Rav goes to Berlin. Why? Can anyone help me out? Could you imagine on what level the college was in Warsaw? I don't want to offend anybody. We're now comparing Touro College to Harvard University. Get the message? You know what Berlin was at that time? I mean, this is just amazing. Where the Nazi, the Rav, you see it in my book. Some of the Rav's own professors that the Rav was intimate with became Nazis. Yimach Shmam B'Zichram. Nazis. I have all the details in my book. It's unbelievable. You know what the pool was? Who was in Berlin at the time? Who were the Rav's classmates, playmates? Give me some names. No? The Lubavitcher Rebbe. Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, later of Chaim Berlin, the Pachad Yitzchak. Who else? Professor Avram Yeshua Heschel, who I don't know if the Rav knew him yet in Berlin. It's an interesting thing. Who else? I mean, if he knew him intimately. I mean, Nechama Leibowitz. Nechama Leibowitz. You have any idea what the attraction was? The Rav's cousins, the Karakovsky boys, their father was Rabbi Nachum Karakovsky, the Avodat HaMelech, the famous Avodat HaMelech and the Rambam. His sons were in Berlin at the time. I saw a picture of the Rav standing with his two cousins, and the Rav writes in the back of the picture, he sent it to his father, Mi hachi yafe betmuna, who is the best looking in the picture? And he meant himself. He was taller. You know, the other guys were short. He was taller. You see, I have part of that picture. I have the picture of the Rav, but I'm not allowed to show it to anyone. It's a treasure, and they won't let me show it to anyone. It's unbelievable. We'll try a different microphone after class. I think it's a microphone problem. Anyway, so you can understand why he goes to Berlin. Now, why did I say 25/26? Here, too, we have a terrible problem. The Rav, in Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein's article, The Rabbi Aaron writes, the Rav went to Berlin in 1925. All my life, I believe the Rav went to Berlin in 1925. In the papers that Manfred Lehman dug up, the Rav applies to the University of Berlin to be accepted for 1926. So we have a real contradiction in terms of years. I asked Aaron again, where did you get the 25? Aaron says to me, we knew it. It was everyone. It was assumed. It was this. It was that. I have a footnote. I don't know what's correct. Shulamit Meiselman is inclined to accept 26. For me to accept 26 is like to believe I was born in 38, not in 37. Because all my life I grew up, the Rav was 22, he went to Berlin, 1925. The document would seem to indicate 1926, which would agree with memoirs out of Hildesheimer that the Rav audited classes in Hildesheimer in 26, 27. So see, it would seem to make sense. Now, this will explain to you, and this is the final point I want to make today, this will explain to you
the Rav's special relation with Rav Menachem Genack. Did you ever wonder? Well, again, you never saw it, but Rav Menachem Genack was literally like the Rav's son. At that point, Chaim Rady was living in Israel. Chaim was jumping back and forth. He was the 60s into the 70s, and the Rav leaned on Menachem Genack literally like his son. How did the Rav have such a close relationship? Of course, Reb Moshe's Talmud Mufak in Tachkamoni, the Mizrahi Rabbinical Seminary in Warsaw, was Reb Elia Moshe Genachovsky. I hope I have the name right. Reb Elia, I hope it's Moshe. If I'm wrong, you'll correct it from my book. But Genachovsky, Reb Elia Chaim, could be it's Reb Elia Chaim Genachovsky. You have to check it out. He was Reb Moshe's Talmud Mufak. He went to Berlin. And Rav Moshe felt confident about the Rav's going to Berlin because he entrusted the Rav into the hands of Genachovsky, who was older than the Rav, and therefore Rav Moshe felt that his Talmud, Rav Elia Genachovsky, would be able to keep an eye on the Rav. And Menachem Genack's father is a brother, or was a brother, to Reb Elia Genachovsky. The original family name is Genachovsky, and it was later in America shortened to Genack, so that Menachem Genack is a nephew to the Rav's closest friend and playmate, both in Warsaw and later in Berlin. And finally, this is the famous moment that the Rav spoke about so many different times, how the great day or the big day has come, and they go to the train station in Berlin, in Warsaw, and they're waiting for the train to Berlin. And Rav Moshe is accompanied by his students, by his colleagues, by his admirers, and everyone has come to see the Rav off to Berlin, and remember in those days what travel was like. And as the Rav said, we never even knew if we would see each other again. We might have been parting forever. Who knew? Reb Moshe doesn't even kiss the Rav. The Rav gave many drashot, and now in his family, you don't show your love. Only love for God is shown. Outside of that, you don't show your love. Reb Moshe never even kissed the Rav. All he did in front of the assembled people, he shook hands with the Rav and said, the Eibishter, God should be matzliach, zoltaych matzliach sein, you should succeed in what you're doing. And those were the parting words from a father to a son that was now entering a new chapter. So to reiterate, what did we do today? The first part of the Rav's life. The Rav's life can be characterized by the three B's: Brisk, Berlin, and Boston. We've ended the period where Brisk is the dominant influence when all is said and done. Although the Rav never lived in Brisk, he basically lived in Pruzhana or Pruzhin, from there to Rezain, from there to Haslovich, which certainly is the greatest influence of his young life. It's always to Haslovich that he goes back, because the truth is, not one person in this class remembers what he did when he was 2 or 3 years old. But you already remember what you did when you were 7 and 8 and 9, and that's when the Rav reaches Haslovich. That was the greatest influence in his life. From there to Warsaw, and we now are on the Autobahn, on the train station, as the Rav has left for Berlin. The influences in his life, no question about it. The Chabad Rebbe, with all that far-reaching influence with philosophy, etc. His father, Reb Moshe, all of Reb Chaim, all of the New Derech, all of the Brisker analysis, so many Masechtot that he learned with his father. And finally, his mother, who gives him, encourages him, the high school equivalency, go to Berlin, open your vistas, study, it's a new world out there, literature, Haskalah, there's nothing that the Rebbetzin is afraid of. And this is the first part of the Rav's life.
I'm just struggling with Yanachovsky. I'm Reb Elia Chaim, Reb Elia Moshe. I think it's Reb Elia Chaim. But I have it all in my book. I have everything researched thoroughly with all the names there. He later went on to become a Chaver Knesset. And I'll tell you, he later went on to become a very wealthy individual. It's a self-made, wealthy Israeli family. You know how he became wealthy? After World War II, there was a tremendous need for Sfarim. He was the owner and founder of El HaMakarot. You don't remember, but in the 1950s, they published, republished the Shas, they republished the Shulchan Aruch, they republished the Rambam. In the 50s into the 60s, they probably were the largest publisher of Sifrei Kodesh, Al Admat HaKodesh. Now, his son is Dov Genachovsky, who writes for the Israeli newspapers. He's the economist, he's a Frum fellow, he lives in Rehavia. He writes writes for all the papers. I mean, maybe a freelancer. That is his son. He appears on the radio. You haven't heard him? Dov Genachovsky. That is a first cousin to Menachem Genach. You see? That's the interrelationship. And that's how the Rav was so close to Menachem. And that also explains how Rav Moshe couldn't object to his going to Berlin. Because first of all, secular study, his wife, the new world. And number two, his best Talmud in Warsaw, who was a few years older than the Rav, is also going to Berlin. The Rav rooms with Genachovsky. So with this intimate relationship, Reb Moshe was at peace with himself. And that's the train that leaves. Thank you for your kind participation. Be'ezrat Hashem, in Tul Sukkot, we have one more shiur following Rosh Hashanah before Yom Kippur. We're dealing with Pilegish in the other course. And this class will pick up after Sukkot. I'll put up a sign, but I don't know when Sukkot ends. I haven't looked at a calendar. But whatever it is, I'll check that you're in, and we'll put up a sign, and we'll pick up, and God should help us. It's a very fascinating journey. Until we meet again in health and happiness, aktiva v'chatima tova, lishnat chayim, osha v'yosha v'kol tov sela, and sheyemolo Hashem et mishalot libchem letova, which is very important at your age. And until we meet again in health and happiness, das v'danya. Thank you very much.